Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Jones and Laughlin Steel Company against Pfeiffer.
I would think this thing is almost exactly along to a disability claim and a lot of the insurance company. You go in and pepper and check it.
Pretty good little asset. Mr. Murdoch, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case is before you on a writ of certiorari from the Third Circuit Court of Appeals and presents two questions for your consideration. First question will be an interpretation of some of the provisions under Section 905A, 905B, and 933 of the Longshoremen and Harbor Workers Act. Second question is a question regarding the measure of damages which was applied by the lower court and affirmed by the Third Circuit in this particular case. By way of background, the respondent was an employee of Jones & Laughlin Steel Corporation. He had worked for them on the rivers, particularly on the Monongahela River for Jones & Laughlin, for many years. He was entitled as having the duties of being a barge helper and barge handler. In doing so, he would go out and he would work with the barges. So that you are aware of the situation, on the Monongahela River, Jones and Laughlin had two landings. First landing had an elevator which they would take these barges, and the barges being approximately 175 feet long, 26 feet wide, under the coal elevator. This would then empty the barge as the coal goes into the mill for use. And persons like Mr. Pfeiffer would then be in charge of taking care of the fleet as the empty barges would be moved down to the other fleet. Mr. Pfeiffer was injured on January 13, 1978, at which time he came out to work on the midnight shift. He did not work his normal job at that time. His normal job was a Class 7 job, but as he would do from time to time, he would come out and he worked as a headman. This was a Class 13 as far as the pay was concerned. In that position, Mr. Pfeiffer was in charge of two other individuals, and these three individuals in that particular shift would then go out and take care of the barges. By taking care of the barges, they would make sure that the lashings were tight. If it was necessary to pump out any barges which were taking on water, this was one of their duties. Also incumbent upon Mr. Pfeiffer and the people he was working with was to make sure that the gunnels, which would be the walkways on the barges, and the deck ends where the people would walk, would be free and clear of snow. As I say, Mr. Pfeiffer came out to work at midnight on this particular shift, and sometime later, 3 a.m., 4 a.m., while going out with two other individuals to pump a barge, he slipped on some ice and snow that had been accumulated on the barge and injured his back. As a result of that incident, then, Mr. Pfeiffer did sign the proper forms for getting payments under the Longshoremen and Harbor Workers Compensation Act. And I think it's important for you to know as a court that Jones and Laughlin has been paying Mr. Pfeiffer the compensation benefits as called for under this act ever since the date of the accident. At the time of the trial in this particular case, in which there was a final verdict rendered against Jones and Laughlin Steel Corporation, in the amount of approximately $275,000, there was a set-off which was approximately $33,000 for the compensation benefits which had been made to Mr. Pfeiffer as of the date of the trial. I believe it's also important for you to know that even today, as I stand here arguing this case before you, we are still making payments under the Compensation Act as called for. I think this is relatively important because 905A of the Longshoremen and Harbor Workers Act sets forth what we refer to as the exclusivity provision. which states basically that a person injured under the Longshoremen and Harbor Workers Act has exclusive remedies to receive compensation from the employer. This is why I've pointed out that under these circumstances, we have been and, in fact, are still paying, because as Jones and Laughlin looks at and reviews the exclusivity provision, we feel that that is the only basis that an employee is to receive benefits from the employer.
Well, that would be traditional in most workmen's compensation type claims, but what do you do with the language of this court in the Edmonds case, which seems to have rejected your position, and in this limited situation would say that the ship owner is still liable both under the underlying tort claim and as under the Act?
Well, I think, Justice O'Connor,
you think we were in error in
I believe you are in error, yes. I don't believe that when you review Edmonds, which in that particular instance concerning the point that I'm talking to you about today was strictly dicta, it was not a part of that particular case, although it was part of the discussion.
But it was a pretty clear statement. Is there not legislation pending in Congress now to change this precise?
There is, and the legislation history, as it appears, although the amendments to the Longshoremen and Harbor Workers Act are still pending, have set forth the case of Griffith versus Wheeling-Pittsburgh as being something that was not intended from the 1972 amendments. Now, if I can give you some background, in 1972 there was an amendment whereby 905B, which is the section that was discussed in Edmonds, came into play. And as I look at the Edmonds decision, as I look at the Griffith Wheeling-Pittsburgh case, I feel that what was done in that particular instance, though, was the failure to look at sections 905A, 905B, and section 933 as they are all read together. Now, this court, even as recently as last Wednesday, set forth in the case of Lockheed versus United States that 905A was the exclusive remedy under the Longshoremen and Harbor Workers Benefit Act. As we look at 905A, it simply says this is the only thing that the employee is entitled to. Getting to 905B, looking at the legislative intent to the amendments back in 1972, as we have in most workers' compensation areas, you had the quid pro quo. You had the giving up of any right that they might have had before the amendments to sue for unseaworthiness or to sue for indemnity in response for largely increased benefits. And these benefits are taken under Section 910. And they set forth that as of June 1st of each year, the different values are placed on as to what the increase is going to be for the benefits, and then they are implemented in October of that particular year. So the position that we have here is that because of the 1972 amendments giving such a large increase of benefits to these longshoremen, that it did away with what was the dual capacity. And I think it's important when you look at 905B as it applies to 905A and 933. 905B basically starts off by saying that any person injured under this particular act and has the benefits of this act. And I strive that it says any person, because in looking at the Edmonds case, there's a distinction that the court brought out or the court intended to bring out by saying that the first sentence only applies to a longshoreman. And I disagree with that because if you go one step further, it says in 905B, if there is the right, then to sue the vessel or vessel as a person, that the employer cannot be directly or indirectly liable. So where I think, where I have the problem with Edmonds is that it did not go far enough with the language. You have 905A, which basically says exclusively you get the benefits. The employer is not to suffer any more manner of making payments. Section 905B reiterates this. It says that the employer cannot be directly or indirectly liable to the injured employee on behalf of the vessel. And if we look at Edmonds and we try to determine the way it was with Edmonds, then you're saying basically that the injured employee can sue the vessel But in the same token, if the vessel is owned by the employer, it's literally the employer that is making the payments. So it's really a way of getting around the language as far as what 905A was. And it is our contention that in 905B, as the second part of the first sentence, where it says that the employer may not be directly or indirectly liable to the employee for the vessel, then they are, in fact, reiterating in 905B the exclusivity provision that it had in 905A. Going one step further, in that same sentence in section 905B, it does make reference that if any action can be filed by the injured employee, it would be in accordance with section 933 of the same act. Edmonds did not address itself to that particular section. Section 933 of the act sets forth that the injured employee, if he determines that the injuries were in fact caused by somebody other than the employer or an employee of the employer, he has the right in the third party action. So I think you have in 905A, 905B, and 933, you have three distinct places where the intent of Congress was to limit any payments that the injured employee would get from the employer to solely the situation of receiving the compensation benefits. The trade-offs, as I've indicated, if you look at the legislative intent and language, which I've cited in my brief, set forth specifically that the intent of the Longshoremen and Harbor Workers Act was to place maritime workers in similar situations into the same situation that a land-based employee has under workers' compensation. And I believe that the Court is well aware that in the cases where we have the state workers' compensation law, that the employee who is injured does, in fact, have the right to get the benefits under the Compensations Act. He has no other benefits at that time. There's nothing to preclude him, as I feel the intent of 905B was, to sue, let's say, the manufacturer of a machine upon which he was injured, as long as it was not owned by the employer. So I think in looking at the 1972 amendments, when you put them all together without taking them out of context, that you can see that the overall intent was simply to put these longshoremen on the same basis of land-based employees to get only that type of benefit. Now, 905B does also provide that somebody who is injured, who is not an employer, or not can sue somebody who is caused the injury. But again, if there is any liability or any money to be paid by the employer, then they're not going to receive payments. We had raised this contention in the pleadings. I had raised it as a motion for summary judgment in the lower court. And of course, the Third Circuit looked at it. But this is the first time, I believe, that this issue has been before this court. And although there has been discussion in Edmonds and in other cases, I do feel that what we're looking at is a situation that the intent of Congress was overwhelming to limit the recovery that a longshoreman could get. I might point out also that if we get this interpretation, then also we're looking at minimizing litigation costs, because I think if you look at the true intent, then the employees who are injured will, in fact, be getting their compensation benefits, which are quite high under the circumstances of this act. And there's not going to be these types of actions which are going to take up the time of the trial courts in order
to... Mr. Murdoch,
yes.
Just to clarify one point, you never contested the finding of the trial court that the ship owner was negligent. Is that right?
That is correct. That was not raised, Justice
All right.
O'Connor. I would like to point out on that, though, that the finding of negligence, if you want to look at a dual capacity, was not made clear, because although there was a finding of negligence as the owner pro hoc vi, it did not make a distinction as to whether or not there was finding of negligence as an employer or as a vessel. And I think that is the distinction that which should have been made.
But for our purposes, we assume that there was negligence as a vessel owner, right?
No, I don't think we can assume that. I think that because it is unclear as to what the court did, perhaps you have to assume that in order to determine this particular question.
Question
that's
that
correct.
You want to raise.
Yes.
So I'm assuming we must assume that that is the case.
That's correct, Justice.
Well, the issue just isn't here.
I'm sorry, did I
say the issue just isn't here?
On the particular 905B?
Yeah, the issue of negligence is not here, not before us.
In what way? I don't understand. I'm sorry, Justice Blackmun.
Well, your colloquy, your colloquy with Justice O'Connor indicated that the issue is not here.
Well, I believe the issue is here. I believe, as I stated before talking with Justice O'Connor, that we had preserved that particular point. There's no question that there was a finding of negligence. It is our position that the lawsuit should not have been allowed to be filed because of the fact that Mr. Pfeiffer was the employee.
But we are not to pass on the issue of negligence.
That's correct. That was not raised at the time of the argument. If there are no other questions concerning that question, I'll go on to the second question. The second question was the standard of the measure of damages, which was decided by the lower court and then affirmed by the Third Circuit. In 1980, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decided the case of Kaskaski versus Bolibays. And in that particular case, they had adopted what had been known as the Alaska Rule, which is basically the total offset method. Total offset method, the lower court assumed that any inflation which may arise in the future would be the equivalent and be offset of any interest rates, so that rather than discounting to the present value, that whatever the value of the lost future earnings were going to be, or the capacity of future earnings, that was what the measurement was. In this particular case, as I stated before, the lower court came to the conclusion, based upon a work life of 12 years, that Mr. Pfeiffer would have been making $26,000 for those 12 years. He multiplied this. There was a finding that Mr. Pfeiffer could do some minimum wage. So that was projected over the work life expectancy. That was deducted in addition to the workman's or longshoreman's compensation benefits that we had paid as of the date of the jury or the non-jury verdict. That was deducted. As our position, as we told the lower court and put in our proposed findings of fact, that it was going to be necessary in the event that there was a verdict in favor of the plaintiff, that there was going to have to be a reduction to present worth. This was not done, as it was just assumed, as I state, that the inflation was going to offset the interest rates, and therefore whatever the figure determined at that time was going to be what the plaintiff would get. We submit to this honorable court that this is a decision upon which there is really no basis to make this type of finding. I think when we look at the purpose of determining why we give a lump sum award, it is because the lump sum award, if it's given directly to the plaintiff at the time of the trial, is going to be worth much more after investing than it would be by the reduction to present value, which is what this court set the standard to be in 1916 in the case of Chesapeake versus Kelly. Also, as recently as 1980 in the case of Liepelt, there was the same reiteration that in order to arrive at a full value, a fair figure for impairment of future earnings or lost wages, that there must be a reduction of present worth. That was ignored by the Third Circuit, and this is the only circuit which has adopted this measure of damages in a federal action. We submit that it should not be done so. There have been many cases set forth in our brief and also in the briefs of the amicus which have filed on our behalf, setting forth the problems that even economists have with making a determination as to how to determine if, in fact, we're going to have inflation and be able to project inflation at a particular rate over a long time period. I think with what we have seen in the economy in the last 3, 4, 5 years, with the spiraling inflation rates, with the governmental steps to come in and try to reduce inflation, with determining whether or not we're in a recession or a depression, with all the economic factors, the economists cannot even agree from past events what caused those, and it has been held almost uniformly, although there are some circuits which are making a distinction, that inflation is too speculative to have somebody come in and make an argument, give evidence to a fact finder to project over a long time period. What we are suggesting is that the proper measure of damages would be to get back to what we still call the traditional approach. The traditional approach being that there can be evidence of a particular category of individuals in a particular geographical area, and there can be testimony of somebody to come in as an economist to set forth that there would be a likelihood of increased wages, but not to get into the convoluted type of testimony that we have with inflation.
So under your view, you start with the reduction of the award to present value and then permit it to be augmented by testimony as to increased wages?
Well, I think we would do it sort of backwards, Justice Rehnquist. We would have the testimony as to merit increases, productivity increases, the fact for particular occupation that the plaintiff is involved in, that there would be the likelihood of increase of wages.
So what the jury ought to do is to consider that testimony as to future earnings, perhaps higher wage rates or promotions in the future, and then after they get the total award, they go through the mechanics of reducing it to present value?
That's correct, Justice Rehnquist. We think this is the most fair because I think as litigators and being in and out of courts, one of the things we want to do is to try to get the type of testimony which is not going to be convoluted, which is not going to increase the time of trial, the cost of trial, and also put it on the basis that some fact finders, jurors, can then make a decision as to what they should give a person who is injured. I think this is fair because one of the things that we strive to do in courts is to make it a system that is fair not only for the defendants but for the plaintiffs. The history has shown that any increase in inflation has not kept up with any increase as far as interest rates are concerned. You have problems if you project, such as in Kaskaski, the inflation, basically the inflation, because you're going to assume then that even the increases of salary are going to keep up with rates of inflation. And I think that the past history has shown in the cases that we have cited and that the amici have cited that this just is not so. So what I am suggesting, as I say, we want to preclude the introduction of speculation, which is basically, as I say, convoluted, reduce it to present worth. You have a built-in factor there that if interest rates are going to increase, that the increase then from the interest rates can be reinvested, and this will also benefit the plaintiff. So I'm not looking at a situation where we're trying to cut down as far as what the plaintiff is going to get, but to make it something that is workable for the court system, fair to both parties, and still something that can cut down on the litigation costs.
The SG has filed a brief in this case on the damages question, suggesting, I think, a different approach than you're suggesting, if I understand it correctly.
That's correct.
And one that would propose that perhaps it's all right to consider the inflationary factors, both in as applied to the discount element and as applied to the wage prospective wage increase, but suggesting that this court shouldn't finally determine as between some of the approaches now used, which is better?
Well, as far as what they have suggested, they're talking specifically about what would be the Feldman case and the DACA case, where they had an adjusted discount rate. I'm not so sure that they really did apply inflationary and non-inflationary matters before they applied the discount rate at that time. One of the problems I have with their approaches is that they do assume, in fact, that the wages that those particular plaintiffs lost or their earning capacity in the future would have, in fact, kept rate, would have increased with inflation. And I don't think that they can do that. What I am suggesting is I think is the better situation, because if you look at the Feldman case, they had a 1.5% discount rate. DOCA had a 2% discount rate. But I believe in the DOCA case, the Court of Appeals specifically said, we are not suggesting that it be this 2%. It might be 3%. It might be 4%. There were other approaches set forth in the other briefs, which were filed on our behalf. And I do think that the discussion does show that the inflation factor should not be part of the testimony. And I think that this Court should look at the vitality of Kelly and reaffirm it in light of this particular question. What I would be concerned about is that as we look at the uniformity provision of wanting the same type of standards to look at in all the circuits, that this Honorable Court is certainly going to have to make some determination as to what guidelines would be. At most, we would suggest that the Kaskowski case or the total offset method, which was adopted in this case, be overturned because there is no precedent for it, there is no evidence for it. I think it is improper. And if there are no other questions, I would like to reserve.
I have a question, Mr. Merrick, if I may.
Yes, sir.
The calculation of the award in this case is set forth in the red brief on page 17. They explain how they get the $275,000. I have two questions I just didn't understand. Did they not subtract from, in the calculation, the future payments of compensation under the Longshoremen's Act?
No, they didn't.
Why not? I don't understand.
Well, the $33,000 which is subtracted there was the compensation payments we had made from the date of injury
right.
to the date of trial.
Now, why wouldn't they also, if they subtracted an amount for the minimum wage, why wouldn't they also subtract the, maybe that wasn't raised?
No, I'm sorry. The minimum wage, Justice Stevens, which was deducted was $66,000.
Correct.
Then the $33,000.
But this, the minimum wage, the $66,000, as I understand it, is the minimum he would have earned in the future.
Over the 12 years, yes, sir.
Now, why wouldn't they also subtract the 12 years of future workman's compensation payments?
Well, what the court indicated was going to happen was that if, in fact, there was going to be an appeal at the time, there was a final decision in this case, that we would then make a determination as to what had been paid at that time. Because what happens from a practical standpoint is that if a lump sum award is going to be given to Mr. Pfeiffer, no further payments are made at that time.
We are
given credit for that.
I see. Then my next question is there any place in the papers a calculation similar to this of what your expert or what your position in the trial court was as to the proper award?
No, there was not much evidence on that, Justice Stevens. We did not have an expert witness per se. We had somebody from the payroll office who was high up in the payroll office who came in and talked about it. But we did not project anything.
If you did not offer evidence that in this case the award would have been lower under your theory, how do you have standing to – I mean, I don't understand whether there's a – you have standing to claim reversible error on the damage.
We argued at the time, not only in proposed findings of fact, but during the trial, that in order for there to be a proper decision as to any damages which were going to be awarded, that there would have to be the reduction to present worth.
Did you offer evidence showing what that would have produced?
No, we didn't. We felt that that was the burden of the plaintiff, and that we felt that if the court would come in and apply what we felt was the proper standard of damages.
But it seems to me it's at least theoretically possible that your approach would have produced a higher damage award.
And if I don't believe so, because traditionally in Pennsylvania there has been a reduction to 6%.
Well, but can we look, just looking at the record in this case, Can we be sure you would have been better off under your theory?
You have nothing in the record before you on that. I would like to reserve whatever time I have.
Very well. Mr. Levinson?
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. There are two issues in this case. The first is whether a longshoreman may sue his employer in negligence as vessel owner under 905B of the Longshoremen and Harbor Workers' Compensation Act. I'll refer to this as the Act as I go through my argument. The second is whether the lower court properly calculated damages on the record before it. Both these issues were affirmed in the lower court in favor of my client, the respondent. The Longshoremen and Harbor Workers' Compensation Act was passed in 1927, but it was significantly amended in 1972 to add 905B for the first time. 905B put into statutory form permission to bring an action against the vessel as a third party in negligence instead of unseaworthiness, which was the previous method of claim. As Justice O'Connor pointed out, the petitioner J&L's negligence in its ownership capacity is not before this court. Furthermore, J&L admitted that it was owner pro hoc vice of all the barges in the fleet on January 13, 1978, when Howard Pfeiffer was injured when he slipped on an accumulation of snow and ice on a gunwale. I don't know if the court is familiar with how barges are assembled on the Allegheny River, but these are coal barges, and they are assembled and lashed together in what they call a fleet, and the barges are moved in or out of the fleet to unload or load coal to the steel mill. And the point is that of the 35 barges that were there that night, or 40 barges, the ownership of those were all J&Ls under the pro hoc vice theory, whether or not they actually did own them or not. However, J&L would have you treat this case differently if my client fell on a non-owned barge in the same fleet, which is contrary to the intent of the Act. Under 905B, all longshoremen are to be treated the same, and there should be no difference whether the vessel is employer-owned or third-party-owned. The fact is that the employer assumes a dual capacity, as all the circuit courts have found, of ownership of the vessel. They don't have to do this, but when they do it, the Act applies to them as it would apply to any other vessel owner. The incidence of their being an employer of the person who's injured is incidental to the fact of their ownership of the vessel. Now, and I submit to you that the award in this case should not depend on the fortuitous event or happenstance of how a person or where a person happens to fall if he's going to be injured. The 1972 amendments to this Act were brought about because of the this Court's findings in the cease shipping against Saraki and in the Ryan case. During the period between 1927 and 1972, the practice was for a vessel to ask for an indemnity agreement from any stevedore company, and the effect was that any injury or claim against the vessel under unseaworthiness was paid in finally by the stevedore company under the indemnity agreement. Congress felt that this was improper, and in passing the amendments in 1972, took away the unseaworthiness doctrine, the indemnity provisions. It expanded the Act by increasing the benefits, but it also, in effect, ratified Reed and Yakka, Reed against Yakka and Jackson, which this Court had passed, and permitted a suit against the vessel itself under 905B. This court in Edmonds, speaking through Justice White, considered 905B and stated, to permit a third-party suit against the vessel providing its own loading and unloading services when negligence in its stevedoring capacity contributes to the injury. The second sentence means no more than that all longshoremen are to be treated the same, whether their employer is an independent stevedore or a shipowner stevedore, and that all stevedores are to be treated the same, whether they are independent or an arm of the shipowner itself. Justice White further cited the congressional hearing reports and stated that in footnote 12 in his opinion, that Congress ultimately decided to preserve the longshoremen's tort action against shipowners acting as shipowners. The legislative goal of passing 905B was the safety of the longshoremen. And the committee reports say that the committee recognized the progress that has been made in reducing injury in the longshoring industry, but longshoring remains one of the most hazardous types of occupations, and the committee expects to see further progress in reducing the injuries and stands ready to immediately examine the third-party question. The point is that Congress felt that by preserving the action against the vessel, it would have a salutary effect on the vessels to ensure their safety. The circuit courts that have, there are six circuit courts that have addressed this question since the 1972 amendments have been in effect, and all of them have found, have arrived at a finding that is in conformity with Griffith and in the result in this case. I believe that this court, speaking through Justice Powell and Peffer, stated that this was a remedial statute, and the amendments were made out of solicitude for the workers. And Justice O'Connor very recently, since the filing of our brief in Director against Perini, cited the committee reports for authority as to what the Act meant. And I think if this Court will again refer to the Act and the committee reports, they should have no problem with 905B. Congress's intent was to treat all longshoremen alike, whether employed by an independent stevedore or a shipowner stevedore, and to impose liability on shipowner stevedores for negligence in their ownership capacity. This comports with the legislative intent of encouraging safety on vessels and holding an employer owner to the same standards as any other shipowner when acting in its shipowner capacity. To deny Pfeiffer's recovery due to the mere happenstance of his being injured on an employer-owned or pro hoc vice vessel would be grossly unfair and contrary to legislative intent and the circuit cases, and would remove any incentive to shipowner employers to exercise due care in their ownership capacity in this case. Also point out to this Court that there is no double recovery, as Justice Stevens asked and was advised. The award in this case is deducted from the compensation in this case is deducted from the award. So there is no double recovery. The employer is repaid any payments it makes under the compensation. Jones and Lachman undertook ownership responsibilities, failed to live up to its responsibilities, must therefore be held liable in negligence for the injuries to my client under 905B. The question of damages and the proper method of determining damages is also before this Court. First of all, I point out to the Court, as Justice Stevens has asked, there is a complete waiver on the part of the petitioner to raise this question. There is the local rules of the district court in which this was tried require any expert testimony to be proffered in a pretrial statement with a report from the expert and before an expert is permitted to testify. There was no report filed by the petitioner nor and any evidence offered in this behalf.
Well, the burden of proof, Mr. Lemonson, isn't the burden of proof as to the amount of damages he's entitled to recover on someone in Mr. Pfeiffer's shoes?
Well, the initial burden, but if they are going to contest the award, They have to offer their own evidence, Your Honor.
Well, granted that they can't rely on any testimony other than that already adduced, but okay. Supposing your expert takes the stand and due to a slip of communications between you and your expert testifies favorably to the defendant. The fact he's your expert doesn't mean the defendant can't rely on his testimony.
I agree, but in our case, we offered in the known wages, and we put in the wages of the man higher above and below my man in seniority to show what he would have earned over the period of time up to the time of trial. In addition, we offered in evidence the known union contract, which had certain increases in it, I think through 1982, although the trial, I think, was in 79 or 80. But just Judge Cohill in the district court, though, decided after looking at this case that there was no federal common law.
Well, but let's return to your waiver point. Supposing that after precisely the same testimony as was adduced here, which I take it was your expert on the question of damages.
We had no expert, Your Honor.
Who was it?
There was no expert. We just put in the wages, the wage losses, and we're satisfied to proceed with that.
Well, supposing that Judge Cole had then said, I don't care what the law is elsewhere, I think inflation is 20% a year. And so I'm going to figure a factor of 20% a year in on the basis of this testimony and made his award accordingly.
He didn't do that.
I realize that. But do you think that the defendant would be prevented from urging on appeal that Judge Cole had applied the wrong measure of damages simply because the defendant hadn't produced
it? Well, you're presupposing, Justice Rehnquist, that he went outside the record, which he did not do. And that's my point.
But the law of damages doesn't necessarily depend on the record. It's the body of law that you find in cases, not in the record.
If I could answer your question by directing your attention or inviting your attention to the Alma case against Manufacturers Hammond over Trust in the Ninth Circuit, which stated that in the absence of evidence on the reduction or by either side, the court is not obligated to go ahead and sua sponte do it.
Well, but the Third Circuit did go ahead here. And Pardon? Considered various rules of damage.
I think the Third Circuit did essentially what the Ninth Circuit did in Alma, and it addressed the record in front of it. And what it did was say that whether or not the Longshoremen and Harbor Workers Compensation Act considered inflation and whether or not there was federal law precedent at that time. And my point is that the act itself, unlike the Sherman Act, does not have a treble damage requirement. It has no requirements as
but
to
the,
damages.
But the Third Circuit, unless I wholly misread its opinion, affirmatively adopted a rather sweeping change in the law of damages in this kind of case, at least for that circuit. Now, do you dispute that?
Well, I don't dispute it, but I think the answer is that there was no law of damages in a fixed manner at that time. And what the Third Circuit did was evolve, if you will, federal common law, like any other common law that's evolved.
But it certainly wasn't a rule of damages applicable to only these particular facts and only this particular case. It laid down a fairly sweeping rule, whether there was a preceding rule or not.
Well, I think it was discretionary for the Third Circuit to adopt the Kaskowski case
It may have been discretionary, but they exercised their discretion to adopt it.
That's true, but I think there was room for it because there was nothing in the federal law at that time that directed them any other way.
No, but now it is the law of the Third Circuit. Well, and I'm not suggesting that they may not have been correct in doing it, but I'm suggesting that your argument about waiver really has little bearing in view of what the Third Circuit
Well, is. My argument to waiver goes to the fact that I don't think the petitioner can ask for a reduction to present worth at this point in time because it's not in the record. That's my point, Your Honor.
The yardstick that the Third Circuit applied is not warranted and justified. What about that?
Well, if they had other evidence before it from which they could argue,
they
could say that it's not
warranted.
Is
that just a matter of evidence?
That's right, Your Honor.
But don't you think they made a new rule?
Well, I think they were entitled to make a new rule under the state of the law as it was before them at the time this case was presented to them. I think that's one of the reasons they took the case, Your Honor, Mr. Chief Justice.
Whether they made the correct rule of law on measuring damages, is it not?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Whether they made the correct rule of law to measure the damages, and that's a question of law, not a question of fact.
Well, that's true, but a law evolves from facts, and I think a court has to have facts in front of it before it can make law.
On what facts do you think the Third Circuit evolved, to use your term, their rule?
All right. I think they utilized the unique situation in this case that there was no precedent governing federal law of damages other than Chesapeake and Ohio. And the Pfeiffer case in the Third Circuit opinion comports with Chesapeake and Ohio against Kelly, a 1916 case, because the set-off of inflation against reduction to present worth in effect is a reduction. And that is what the Third Circuit said. And the Third Circuit also said that this case, their opinion, conforms to Chesapeake and Ohio against Kelly.
Does this involve an assumption that inflation is always going to remain in the state that it is at the day or at the time the Court of Appeals is evolving its new rule?
I think that the history of inflation is recognized by all circuits at this point but the first, and I think everyone on this bench knows that inflation has been present since at least 1950 and has been increasing, and it is a problem that has to be considered.
Do you think we can take judicial notice that it's been decreasing lately?
Well, that's one of the problems in the case. I think it probably will or could, but
Has it not?
Pardon?
Has it not?
Yeah, but it's a variable thing. You see in the newspapers, it changes every day. But this case was tried in 1980, and we're in front of you in 1983.
What was it in 1980, about 11%, 12%?
It was runaway inflation at that time. That's right. The defendant was probably getting 18% on the verdict here that they've been appealing, while the plaintiff got nothing. So, and the plaintiff only gets 6% if he collects on the verdict anyway.
Well, that's a separate but and different matter.
It's a different issue, but I think it illustrates the problem, Your Honor. But also, I think the court should consider that when inflation decreases, interest rates go down too. So the concept of the total offset method has many good features. It is predictable, it's precise, it's inexpensive, and it saves court time. Bringing experts into court can change an argument, or a trial rather, into a trial within a trial, and in many cases totally confuses a jury. As a matter of fact, at this point in time, I think between the various circuits that have considered it, you have possibly four different concepts. You have cases where in the Doka or Feldman or O'Shea where the various courts have said there's a real rate of interest, which is anywhere from 1.5% to 2% to 3%. There's a series of cases where the court just lets it to the jury to consider what inflation is. There's a series of cases that requires expert testimony, and then there's the total offset method. All four wrestle with the same problem as to what is the method. But I think they illustrate that that any one method is just not exclusive, and I think that this court, if it attempted to say that there is one method that's superior to the others, would only run into additional problems on other aspects of damages that would not hold water. The only question that the Third Circuit really answered in his opinion was that they held that the district court did not err in computing damages for future loss of earnings. This is on 16A of the petition for certiorari. Because it is not necessary to go through the process of discounting lump sum awards at theoretical present value. The discount factor is presumed equal to the offset by the impact of inflation on the future economic value of the award. And I submit that the total offset method is as good as others and better from a theoretical standpoint. It's efficient, predictable, and saves court time. And Justice O'Connor, I would like to point out that in the 1982 congressional hearings on amending the Longshoremen Act at page 32, Congress said, however, apart from these limitations on owner vessel, an owner vessel would not be relieved of liability for owner occasion negligence, and cites Lundy against Litton, Smith against Eastern Seaboard, and Griffith. So I submit that Congress has no intention in 1982 of overruling the Griffith case, which this case follows.
And Mr. Liebenson?
Yes, sir.
You intimated a moment ago that you thought the Third Circuit was reviewing the district court's damage award on kind of an abuse of discretion theory. Taking the paragraph of the Court of Appeals opinion beginning at the bottom of page 15A of the petition for certiorari, and continuing over that paragraph till you find the Roman 5 in the middle of the page, do you think that's really a fair interpretation of the Court of Appeals rule?
Your question again, is this a fair interpretation?
Is it a fair interpretation to say that all the Court of Appeals is saying it was not an abuse of discretion for the district court to have applied this rule, intimating that perhaps if the district court had applied another rule, it would have affirmed it too?
I think so. But I think that they, that Judge Aldiser, in writing this opinion, felt that inflation had to be addressed, obviously, from the contents of the opinion, and he felt that this method, if it's going to be addressed, is superior to anything else that has been utilized in the various circuits.
Well, if he felt it was superior, then is it really fair to say that it's a review on an abuse of discretion basis, that if Judge Coyle had applied any one of five or six other rules, that would have been affirmed too?
I think so.
May I ask if you know whether this problem of how to compute damages in an inflationary economy has ever been addressed by any legislature?
I'm not aware of any, Justice O'Connor, Justice Stevens, excuse me.
Were any arguments made to any of the courts along the line that something like a cost of living adjustment could be built into an award?
Well, Your Honor, in the record, in this case, cost of living increases were submitted to the district court that were known under the various, under the union contract. However, that's the reason on page 21 of my brief I was able to demonstrate that if you add in the cost of living increases that were known up to the time of the trial, and then a reduction of the by the 2% method under the DOCA case, you would still come up with about an $80,000 higher verdict than was obtained in this case. But Judge Cohill felt that the Kaskowski case or the Alaska rule of total offset was appropriate, and he applied it in this case. So I hope that answers your question. The I think this court did address inflation in Liepeld, and it said again, future inflation are matters of estimate and prediction. But estimate and prediction is not anything precise. The problem is if the court is looking for a precise and totally accurate damage award, I just don't think they exist. I think the question is if you are looking for a method that is appropriate for most cases and which should be followed, I commend the total offset method to you because, it is comprehensible, efficient, and inexpensive. It will save court time. You will avoid the necessity of expert witnesses, and I think any of you justices who have tried cases with expert witnesses on both sides, you do not get a consensus or an agreement. It's something for a jury to have to decide who to believe anyway.
So. May I ask you one other question? The government comes up with two proposals, both of which differ from the total offset method. Am I correct in believing that both of those, which do in a sense take inflation into account, both of those would represent a change in the law, at least as it was, say, 10 years ago, rather dramatic change in the law?
Well, I think the question of inflation itself represents the change. The question of how to factor it in is the problem. And the method is we could stand.
But both of the government suggestions do factor in inflation in at least partially.
Oh, yeah. I don't disagree with that. I think all the circuit courts, but the first at this time, consider inflation in awards. But the real question is what is the most efficient way of doing it and the fairest way?
Yeah.
And I might add that the total offset method, if it does favor a plaintiff in a very small degree, it should, because the plaintiff is not the culpable party. At that point, he's already established his liability. I submit to this court that Pfeiffer's cause of action against the vessel owned or controlled by his employee, J&L, is valid. The damages were properly calculated in accordance with federal law, and the judgment of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals must be affirmed. Thank you.
We'll resume there at 1 o'clock, counsel, so as not to divide your rebuttal. Mr. Murdoch, you may carry on.
Thank you, Chief Justice Berger. May it please the Court, I would like to cover several points which were raised in Mr. Liebenson's argument. I would respectfully disagree that by having the amendments of 1972 that the Reed versus Yawka case was overruled. I feel that if my interpretation, putting 905A, 905B, and 933 together, would indicate, again, without getting back into my argument, that all actions against a vessel or an employer are completely devoid due to these amendments, and therefore I feel that the negligence actions which are allowed under 905B or for a longshoreman or anyone covered under the Act against somebody other than the employer. As to the payments that come under the workman's compensation benefits, such as we had in this case, I believe that one of the intents, one of the purposes that we have of the workman's compensation statute was to provide regular payments to the individual who was injured. And we have two dangers if this type of action is allowed. First of all, it requires a lump sum payment, which is going to be paid with the stopping of the compensation payments. There's no guarantee that anybody who receives a lump sum payment such as this is going to retain it or have the wise investment opportunities. So I think it's something that it should be considered with the purpose to allow the monetary benefits on a regular basis that these type of actions go against that particular intent.
Well, are you suggesting that ad hoc evaluations could be appropriately made?
Yes, I believe they could. Now, as to the total offset method, I would like to raise something as an example in order to show exactly what we're involved with the total offset method. If we assume that the finding of the court would be that the lost earning capacity in the future would be $180,000 for that particular plaintiff, what the total offset method does is provide $180,000 in that individual's pocket at that time, allows him to invest at the rates, to reinvest at higher rates, so that assuming that he had 10 years of lost productivity, he gets $180,000 plus all of the total interest over that time period. That is not what we're attempting to do when we are determining what amount of money is due to an injured individual. We are determining that if he, in fact, is going to lose $180,000 over his work life expectancy, that by reducing to the present value, that in the ninth and tenth year, in my example, of his work life expectancy, he is going to receive exactly what he would have received had he been continuing to work. Total offset method does not do that. It goes completely against the grain to the prejudice of the defendants. And also, I'd like to point out that under Section 905A and 905B, that it's almost a strict liability situation as far as the employer is concerned. We are required as employers to make these payments, whether there's negligence, non-negligence, or anything like that. And I think this should be taken into consideration. Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...